So to, thank you, Francoise. So good to have this provocation. I've been thinking about Coppola's conversation for some time, but I hadn't really been forced to write out my thoughts. They're still very much in progress, as you'll see. And my conclusions are tentative. I have more questions than answers, I think, in the long run. But to create a kind of interval between Martin's very dense paper and what I'm about to say, I want to play these opening 9 minutes. I have a PowerPoint to do. I had suggested to Andreas, who may soon be a father if he's not already, that I might circulate a Vimeo to the group coming to the conference. And he said, well, we've opened up some space in the conference. Just play your 9 minutes beforehand. So here's the opening 9 minutes of Francis Ford Coppola's The Conversation, 1994.
And you can even put it in full screen.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Ballet.
We can't.
What about me?
Yes.
Somebody's baby boy.
Me?
Who I think was once somebody's baby boy, and he had a mother and a father who loved him, and now there he is, half dead on a park bench. And where are his mother or his father, all his uncles now? Anyway, that's what I always think.
How's he doing up there?
I always think how when they had
moved. Wow, we're getting 40%.
About circumcision.
so here we go. The voice already had a role to play in cinema during the silent era. And the films of pioneering directors like D.W. Griffith adopted, as they often were from works for the stage, actors routinely portrayed characters as speaking with each other. With the film Spectator, to be sure, silent actors communicate chiefly through bodily movement and gesture, often typically with melodramatic facial expression as well. Griffith's development of the facial close-up, often deployed in a non-speaking moment of the film narrative, was aimed partly at enhancing the capacity of the actor's face as a medium of expression not found on stage. And Bela de Blasi, in his wonderful book of the 1920s, The Visible Man, ended up claiming that the visual codes of silent cinema heralded nothing less than a major revolution in cultural modernity. Yet the cinema of Griffith, no less than that of Abel Gance, Erich von Stroheim, or Carl Dreyer, certainly featured much representation of speaking and singing, both visual, we see the actors' mouths move, and textual, we read their words in intertitles. These media made the voice matter to early cinema, even when the voice expressed itself in groans or sighs. With the advent of sound, and specifically sound synchronization, all this changed. Depictions of actors speaking could now be supplemented by the sound of their voices. Hollywood cinema itself offers one of the most interesting studies of this transformation, with all its promise and problems, in Singin' in the Rain, Gene Kelly's musical of 1952. The capacity to sync sight and sound quickly proved, however, to be a spur to further experimentation. The use of sound bridges between shots, for example, was an early innovation that quickly spread. More generally, the technique of locating sounds and voices off-screen became part of cinema's practical and conceptual repertoire, whether in fiction film, documentaries, or in avant-garde work. Further, off-screen voices and off-screen sounds, including music, could be understood as either diegetic or non-diegetic, depending on whether we are meant to understand their sources either inside or outside the world of the film. Other distinctions developed along with these. A given off-screen voice, for example, could involve either a piece of dialogue or a narrative voiceover. A narrative voiceover, like film music, could itself be either diegetic and accompanied by flashback, think of the narration of Double Indemnity by Fred McMurray, or non-diegetic, think of the narration of How Green Was My Valley by Irving Cashel. The French thinker Michel Chion has brought considerable taxonomic clarity to such issues in a series of books over the last couple of decades. My interest here is in one of cinema's own richest responses to these issues, Francis Ford Coppola's The Conversation of 1974, a film that reflexively addresses the later innovations of the sound era, especially with respect to the voice, much as Singin' in the Rain had done for the sound question of sound synchronization in the first place. I want to argue that The Conversation's distinctive engagement with the sound of the voice in cinema and with the evolving technologies on which audibility depends reworks not only Antonioni's Blow Up, 1966, an obvious source acknowledged by Coppola and much discussed, but also Hitchcock's Vertigo, a connection that has gone almost completely unnoticed in existing criticism. So what follows, I want to ask, from the recognition that The Conversation translates Hitchcock's searching study of the cinematic face into a film about the cinematic voice? The Conversation was a pet project of Coppola's long before he won the right to see it produced at Paramount, the studio that produced Vertigo, after the success of his Godfather in 1972. Paramount wanted a sequel to Coppola's big success, and Coppola wanted a chance to direct the screenplay on which he had been working intermittently since the late 1960s. It seems like a Watergate movie, but actually he wrote the script for it in the late 1960s. The Conversation was made on a budget of only $1.8 million. It featured just one star, the emerging Gene Hackman, fresh from his success with The French Connection. A lot of French connections in this film. You saw that city, Paris. It's a kind of, I think he's trying to do a kind of French New Wave cinema, and that's part of why there's so much thematization of the French.
But the film did help launch the very early careers of John Casale, who you saw in that clip, Terry Garr, and Harrison Ford. It was beset by problems start to finish, notably Coppola's firing of the film's first cinematographer, the great Haskell Wexler, after the first weeks of shooting, and Coppola's having to all but abandon the film, pretty much right after he shot it, in order to turn to the making of Godfather II, per his agreement with Columbia, with Paramount. Both of these problems proved to be blessings in disguise. Before being fired, Wexler shot the footage for that extraordinary 9-minute opening, and it became part of the film's distinctive structure that this sequence should be set off stylistically from the bottom of the film, which follows, which was shot by Coppola's friend Bill Butler. As for the editing, Copper turned that over to the brilliant Walter Murch, who cut Coppola's characteristically extensive footage, way more than they needed, into manageable length, and transformed Coppola's own conception of the film in the bargain, including some crucial elements of the plot. We can talk about that later if you like. And indeed, some of the most insightful commentary we have on film editing in general in recent years, especially sound editing, can be found in Murch's later reflections in two different books on his work in this film. The Conversation was nominated for the Oscar for Best Picture, along with Godfather II, to which it lost out, and it later won the Palme d'Or at Cannes in the same year. Coppola himself has named it his own favorite film. To summarize the plot briefly, for those who haven't seen it or seen it recently, it follows a few days in the life of a preeminent sound surveillance technician, Hackman's Harry Call, whom we see on day one in that opening sequence, engaged in a difficult assignment. The job is to produce from three different microphones and positions an intelligible audio recording of a conversation between a man and a woman, Anne and Mark, who are walking around Union Square in San Francisco in the midst of a busy lunchtime crowd. Once back in the warehouse lab, which is the sequence that follows what you just saw, Call succeeds in editing the three tapes together to make a usable recording. In the course of delivering it the next day, however, he finds reason to suspect that the recording has been commissioned by a jealous husband, a powerful executive called only the director, and played in a cameo by Robert Duvall, who may intend serious harm to the couple. Harry's fears for the lives of the young couple eventually lead him to make an uncharacteristic intervention, uncharacteristic because he's a private man who stays out of things. You got a sense of that in the opening. He goes to the couple's announced rendezvous site in room 773 of the Jack Tar Hotel, where he believes the director and others will ambush the trysting couple. Here's a clip, another now, which shows Harry having checked into the adjoining room and doing his surveillance thing. This is about a little long too, it's about 3 minutes, but it's the last long one that I'll show you.
Adrenaline. There's no time for patience or diplomacy.
Open outside line, I mean it.
See?
Let's see, why is this not working? So.
Is it still playing the sound from the
other? I know, it's still playing the sound from the other thing, and I don't know how to solve that. I think I need to get Sebastian. I'm sorry. I'm going to stop this so you don't lose out on the surprise. Okay, good. Thank you. Sorry.
No, no problem.
remember that image, please? Part of the scene. By the end of this sequence, I think I'm okay without the lights if you all of you are. By the end of this sequence, Harry believes that he has overheard the prelude to a crime, the director's murder of his adulterous wife, and that he has caught a fleeting glimpse of the act itself. This hypothesis is not borne out in the denouement. Harry soon discovers, in a surprising revelation, that it is the director who has been murdered, that Anne, his wife, and her accomplice who have taken control of the corporation, and that the conversation he was hired to tape was actually staged by the young couple to produce precisely the sort of recording that would lure the director into the murderous trap. The blood he glimpsed on the glass wall proves to be not Anne's, but her husband's. This bare sketch of the film's murder plot provides only a part of the film's interest, however, for there is another dimension of the film that constitutes an extended character study of the surveillance technician himself, an intensely, even pathologically private man whose paranoia about security and fears of exposure are matched only by the stealth with which he invades the privacy and personal lives of others. In a brief but telling sequence early in the film, Harry visits the apartment of a woman he keeps, literally, in a small apartment, Terry Garr. He taps her phone, spies on her, and makes only surprise visits while at the same time revealing nothing to her about himself, not even his address, phone number, or true age. These hard facts about his character are tempered to a degree by the evident pain of his loneliness. Coppola said that he initially modeled the character on that of the loner Harry Holler in Steppenwolf, Hermann Hesse's cult novel of the 1960s. And one's sympathy for Harry Call, he was originally called Holler and then Caller, and then Harry Call, and a stenographer misspelled Call as C-A-U-L, which stuck and became part of the motif. One's sympathy for Harry Call is also prompted by his loyalty, professional integrity, devout Catholicism, and bad luck. Coppola more than once also suggested that Harry belongs to the gallery of damaged angels he found in plays by Tennessee Williams, one of which Coppola himself actually adapted for the screen. This sense of the film as a hybrid between a psychological thriller and a character study is quite explicit in later comments offered by both Coppola and Walter Murch. Murch called it an unstable alloy. The psychological thriller in this case involves a murder mystery, a major plot twist, and a trail of blood, a formula most immediately associated in the early 70s, even the late 60s, with the films of Hitchcock. Indeed, to support his work on The Conversation, Coppola is known to have spent much time screening and rescreening Hitchcock's films and taking extensive notes on them as he did. I've not gotten my hands on these notes yet. But the brief sequence in the Jack Tar Hotel, for example, it makes it impossible not to see Hitchcock's fingerprints, as it were, on the bloody hand that presses on the frosted glass. And when Harry comes back to the room some hours later to inspect it for signs of blood, he initially finds nothing. But when he flushes the toilet in that apartment, which is completely immaculate, it overflows with blood and presumably body parts. Now, I realize in showing you this sequence, there's a sort of a delay between the next slide, which I don't think I want to, and I don't think I want to leave that up there. So I'll just put this slide here in anticipation of where I'm going. So Walter Murch described this whole sequence quite plausibly as a kind of homage to Psycho. As I've indicated, though, my interest is in Coppola's relation to what is now generally taken to be the greatest of Hitchcock's films, Vertigo, from which this shot comes. The neglect of the connection between these films is really puzzling to me for a number of reasons, not least because Vertigo is, of course, set in San Francisco, its landscapes and monuments figuring prominently in Hitchcock's mise-en-scène. Coppola himself moved from Los Angeles to San Francisco during the long gestation period on this very script in 1969, 5 years before this film was released. And in that same year, he and George Lucas set up Zoetrope Studios in the heart of the city. Coppola simply couldn't have failed to take special note of Vertigo in his preparatory study of Hitchcock's films for this one. Some initial evidence that he did can be found in that Jack Tar sequence. After Harry Cole listens in on the voices, taped in live, and they are both taped in live voices, importantly, and the first sounds of violence, he withdraws from his position and comes back and gazes from time to time at the wall that he originally had listened to and heard nothing. But the voices are loud enough, and what leads him to hear, what he hears leads him to go look and see. But that wall, I want to suggest, figures in the conversation's extended structural motif of permeable audio membranes, and something I want to come back to. But it displays a panoramic view, as you saw, of Coit Tower. It's a familiar enough San Francisco view. It's a kind of cliché piece of wallpaper. But it also happens to recall the view from the apartment of Scotty Ferguson, the retired detective played by James Stewart in Vertigo. Coit Tower is, in fact, mentioned notably as a point of orientation in this exchange between James Stewart and Kim Novak. She says, he asks her how she managed to find his way back to his apartment since she didn't have the address, and she says, I just used the monument of Coit Tower, whereupon he says this is the first time he's ever been grateful for the fact of Coit Tower, a notably unsightly monument on the San Francisco landscape. So in a way, the question I'm posing is what kind of point of orientation Vertigo itself is within the Coppola film. So one index of the larger framework that links these two films can be found in the celebrated credits sequence of Vertigo. I'm not going to show it. I hope you remember it a little bit. It ends up including those bits that were stolen by Mad Men for the opening sequence of Mad Men of the cartoon of the man falling. The opening shot of the credit sequence is half of a woman's mouth and then all of her mouth. But then the camera quickly moves to her eye and remains fixed on her eye while various psychedelic images are spawned from that eye. I don't know if you remember the sequence. Tellingly, the camera never returns to her mouth, and the role of the voice, I want to argue, is suppressed in Vertigo in favor of the face and the wider visual field. Coppola's opening sequence, by contrast, literally, we've just seen, targets a woman's mouth as we see that sniper-like figure high on the building around Union Square, zeroing in on what Anne says in her part of the conversation. So one might say the voice will be central in this film, and so will be the ear that takes it in. In the Hitchcock film, though the ear is actually the site of the disorder known as vertigo, it plays almost no role. But in the conversation, the ear provides both the site of the drama and the crucial evidence of its working out. And just as Vertigo depends architecturally on the structure of the elevated platform, a recurring motif in Vertigo, you remember early on it with Midge, Barbara Galgetti's, Jimmy Stewart climbs up onto the step stool, I can go here, these successive platforms. The end of the film, we see him on the platform of the bell tower looking down, that's the final shot. So that platform motif with the vertical shot looking down are two of the primary structural motifs of the mise-en-scene of Vertigo. In the conversation, I want to say the motif is transposed to the vertical permeable membrane. And that figure of the membrane, which is connected to the typo of the call, Coppola brought in from his, developed out of the stenographic mistake, is really crucial. It's the membrane through which sounds can pass for those who have the capacity or enhanced capacity to hear them. And then consider the striking plot similarities between the two films. Both films, we might say, concern a male protagonist who was hired to conduct surveillance on a woman whom he is led to believe is acting suspiciously. In both films, the man becomes obsessed not only with the surveillance project, but also erotically with the woman herself, a character in each case given markedly maternal associations in respect to the protagonist's infantilism. In both cases, the woman under surveillance proves to be playing a part during that surveillance for surreptitious purposes, and in both cases, the aim of her performance for the surveillance agent is to turn him, by virtue of one of his known character flaws, into an unwitting instrument of the murder of his spouse. So that fairly detailed plot description actually captures the plots of both films. And then finally, in relation to narrative procedure, both films depend structurally on a conspicuously intense use of repetition. There are obvious differences between the films, but many of these, I think, indicate some of Coppola's particular aims in reworking Vertigo. In Vertigo, the detective is hired by the husband, as it were, to keep an eye on his wife, and this is exactly what we see Scotty Ferguson, the James Stewart character, doing through the first half of the film, trailing her by car and by foot, watching her vigilantly with his luminous blue eyes. It is many minutes into Scotty's early surveillance of Madeline before we even hear Kim Novak's voice. It's many minutes into Kim Novak's appearance before we know what her voice actually sounds like. And of course, he becomes famously obsessed with her face, which is itself mirrored in a series of repetitive doublings, often with Scotty's eyes in reaction shots, including, for example, two painted portraits. So here is Kim Novak famously before the statue, sort of before the portrait of a supposed ancestor. Here's Jimmy Stewart in a reaction shot, keeping an eye on her. And then here is the double of Kim Novak in the portrait itself, with the telltale vertiginous hair bun that Jimmy Stewart later in the film will force the new Kim Novak character to, the reappeared Kim Novak character to assume. And especially important, I think, are the ghostly doubles that Scotty Ferguson imagines he sees in revisiting various San Francisco sites after Madeline's apparent suicide a little more than halfway through the film. More on this later. Of course, the whole final third of the film involves the reemergence of Kim Novak as Judy Barton, a somewhat vulgar Kansas shop girl, a double to whom Scotty transfers his obsession in a Pygmalion-like remaking of the presumed dead Madeline. She turns out to be the same person. We learn soon after Judy Barton appears that she was part of the husband's plot to murder his wife by deceiving Scotty, and Scotty reaches the same conclusion when, having finally remade Judy as Madeline to his satisfaction, he sees in her mirrored reflection, again a double, that she is wearing a necklace that could only have come from the murdered husband. It's impossible to consider Vertigo seriously without taking account of this sort of emphasis on faces, doubling, and mirroring. And unsurprisingly, there's a massive critical literature on those topics, and I'm not going to try to summarize any of it here. My interest always is in what Coppola does with this story, his turning of the story of the private eye into that of the private ear, in this case, a very private ear. The translation certainly entails a shift from face to voice, but what was missing from Vertigo, and what Coppola found in Blow Up, was the involvement of technological apparatuses in the production of the image. There is in Vertigo some interest in painting, an element that Hitchcock drew on from D'Entre les Murs, which was the French source text, where painting is very important. But Coppola follows Antonioni in his painstaking examination of an event's staged technological reproduction, a representation that reveals something not perceptible in both cases, Blow Up and the conversation, by the senses unaided. Thus, in the conversation, through distinct phases, Coppola shows Harry Call engaged in a sequence of operations. First, recording the conversation with complex technical expertise, and editing the three tapes to produce an initial master tape, what he calls a fat recording in that little bit we saw. Then returning to his recording after his suspicions are aroused in order to make an audible, to make audible a key line that had been buried under the noise in the initial master tape, precisely under the bongos, and that line is, he'd kill us if he had the chance. Next, reaching a conclusion reinforced by other circumstances that the young couple are in mortal danger, and then finally discovering that this conclusion about the tapes was based on not only a mistaken understanding, but actually a mishearing of the key line. So how do these successive reproductions and reinterpretations of the voice get played out for the audience of the conversation? Fundamentally, I think, by way of what Coppola calls the film's core concept, this is his own term, repetition, which I take to be his version of Vertigo's resort to visual doubling. If the 9-minute opening shot by Wexler, if in that shot we witness in something like real time the work of audio recording this event, and this sequence establishes the themes on which the film will play its variation, then the rest of the film is sequenced actually as a series of actual playbacks, most of them literally triggered by the act of pressing play on a playback mechanism. These are typically supplemented with flashback imagery of the Union Square conversation, but usually with the sounds driving the images, so to speak, and sometimes with new sounds and images to clarify or fill in. The first repetition occurs in his workshop when Harry makes the first tape in the presence of some photos of the event. The second replay takes place in the same location when he returns to improve the master tape. I'll give you just a sense of how this looks for those who haven't seen the film. It's a very short clip. Next repetition occurs, I think I won't play that one, although it's in a way it's the heart of the film. It happens in two phases, one initiated by the John Cassale character who seeks to impress Harry's East Coast rival with Harry's genius, and then in a second phase when Harry himself presses play, we see him press play so that the tape will run as a background to the scene of seduction by the East Coast rival's female assistant, who turns out to be an accomplice in the larger Harrison Ford plot. The fourth replay of the tape occurs when Harry, having been summoned by Harrison Ford to the director's office to be paid for the tapes now in Ford's possession, having been stolen, when he walks in on the moment when the tape is being played for the director, Robert Duvall. Just give you a quick sense of that. Harry's picking up his money. There's Robert Duvall and Harrison Ford. The tape is being played for him. And the last of these literal replays, diegetic replays, occurs in the sequence I began with when Harry overhears snippets of the tape being played in the next room at the Jack Tar Hotel. That's the tape that's being played in that room. And this is the one that he thinks will cost the young couple their lives, but it costs the life of Robert Duvall instead. But the pattern of vocal repetition does not end here. Beyond this skeletal sequence of literal replays, the film includes other sequences in which the initial conversation is reprised without the diegetic playback mechanism, either as a memory flashback or as a non-memory flashback. Such non-diegetic replays take their place, however, in the film's bewildering array of similar devices, including flash-forward sequences, dream sequences, and even a spell of phantasmagoria. It is one of these non-diegetic playback moments toward the end of the film, after Harry has discovered the plot in which he proves to have been a pawn, that we hear one last time with a visual supplement the crucial line that he had worked so hard to filter out of the ambient noise. But now, in this final repetition, the line seems to carry a different emphasis from those from its first iterations. So, this one. This is a flashback. And now we're in the present.
Later in the week, Sunday maybe.
Sunday definitely.
Jack Tar Hotel. 3 o'clock, room 773. Kill us, we got a chance.
This moment of peripeteia in the conversation is thus linked, as Aristotle said it should be in the best plots, with a moment of discovery. And that moment of discovery is registered not visually, as in Scotty's recognition of the necklace in Vertigo, but rather in a newly perceived vocalization. Further, some preparation has been established for this, because earlier in the film, when Stan is explaining how hard it was for Harry to do this, the East Coast rival says, proposing how he would do it, he says, I would get a telescope and read lips, and Stan says, no, you can't do it by reading lips. The client wants actual voices, and he wants the actual voices so he can believe it. So it's another moment where vocalization becomes crucial. So it might seem that then that hearing is believing in this film, and that the voice is a privileged ethical and epistemological medium. Coppola may even have noticed something that seems conspicuously peculiar about Vertigo from the point of view of the conversation. For all of Scotty's obsession with remaking Judy Barton in the image of Madeline Elster, her hair, her makeup, her clothes, he never attempts to address the sort of thing that, let's say, Henry Higgins spends most of his time on in Shaw's Pygmalion, improving her manner of speaking, her shop girl's working-class Kansas accent, so vulgar and so strident in comparison with Madeline's mid-Atlantic English. So although very nearly the final words of Vertigo are spoken in the nun's brief declaration at the top of the tower, I heard voices, voices would seem to be, at best, not much attended to in this film, where they are not systematically suppressed. And this is part of what I think Coppola was trying to open up. But then, what to make of this? It's tempting to think that Coppola's reworking of Vertigo's engagement with doubled faces in this respect as a, involving a shift toward interiority, authenticity, that kind of discourse. Perhaps something consistent with Coppola's effort to add the dimension of a character study grounded in Hermann Hesse and Tennessee Williams to the Hitchcockian thriller. Such a thought would be consistent with Coppola's criticism of Hitchcock's handling of actors, the sort of direction that might seem to be on display in the strangely theatricalized performances of Stewart and Novak in Vertigo. Harry's solitary playing on his saxophone would also seem to be an expression of an interior voice, and his overall performance, Gene Hackman's, an example of the sort of inside-out structure of the method acting generally favored by Coppola, which is obviously on full display in the two Godfather films on either side of this. There is, of course, an ancient tradition for thinking of eye and ear in this way. The eye engages the world as a front, a facing surface. The ear sounds the depths of things. The ear engages the voice as an index of our inner life. It is with the voice, after all, that we confess ourselves. And indeed, we do listen to Harry call in the intimacy of a confessional box with its own instantiation of the film's motif of the sound permeable screen or membrane when the priest slides back the confessional screen. The ear, one might imagine, is supposed to index a realm of privacy and interlife, not accessible to the story of a private eye. But the matter is not so easily settled. Perhaps because of the well-established practice in the post-silent era of filmmaking, in which the sound syncing is so richly complicated by off-screen sounds and voices, in which the distinction between diegetic and non-diegetic sound matters in new ways, the question of what it means to believe in the voice becomes richly complicated in ways that I think Coppola's reworking of Vertigo reveals. And this question is brought to the nub, I suggest, precisely in the moment when we are able to hear the film's key line with a different voicing. Seeing the film in a cinema in 1974, and as I know at least a couple of you did, I was, I recall, deeply confused by this moment in the film. Was this really the same sound clip that had earlier been played? Had I failed, as Harry is supposed to have failed, to hear its emphasis properly in the first iteration? In retrospect, I think I should have asked myself, too, what it meant that the final repetition is vocalized not only off-screen, but also in a non-diegetic register. That is, there's no press play for that moment. And it's the first time we get, not the first time, but it's an important time in which we get the repetition without the pressing of play. But beyond the film, and beyond its moment in 1974, revolutions in playback capacities of all sorts have enabled even home viewers to conduct their own audio investigations. My questions about the final vocalization and whether it was identical to the first was settled when I got my VHS copy of the conversation some years later, and I quickly confirmed my conclusion since, and I've confirmed my conclusion since then, and far more easily when the film appeared in DVD format in 1999. The vocalization we hear in that final repetition, and you could hear it here, he'd kill us if he had the chance, is not the same as the earlier iteration. And in his audio commentary on the DVD release, Coppola admitted as much. How could he not? And Murch, for his part, did his best to justify it. Instructively, there's a parallel here with Vertigo. It happens during the sequence in which, soon after his release from from psychiatric care, following what he thinks is the suicide of Madeline from the church tower, Scotty, the James Stewart character, ventures out into Madeline's old haunts in and around San Francisco, and he begins to see her doubles everywhere. Amid a series of mistaken recognitions, Scotty returns to the restaurant where he first saw her, and at the very table, he sees from the next room a blonde woman in a gray suit whom he thinks is Madeline until she approaches more closely, and we are able to see that it is not she. But with the benefit of DVD, we can now detect that the woman at a distance is actually played by Kim Novak, and the woman on closer approach is played by another actress. I'll just show you this very quickly. I'm pretty sure it's Kim Novak. It's certainly a double who's a lot closer to Sim Novak than the second one. So here is, you can't see it too well, but there's, she comes a little closer. I didn't crop it at the right place. There's the Kim Novak figure, and when she gets closer, there's Jimmy Stewart in the reaction shot, and you see somebody looks not remotely like Kim Novak, and it is definitely not the same actress. So it's a kind of reversal of the practice of the body double, in which, say, an unknown actress would stand in for Kim Novak. She's standing in for the unknown actress. The difference in these two tricks, I suppose, is that the stakes are higher in the conversation by virtue of its emphasis on the role played by mediating technologies. Though it has no diegetic source in that final repetition, the vocalization of the line, "He'd kill us if he had the chance," is clearly meant to be understood as part of Harry's painstaking recording of the conversation. So what should we make of this repetition with the difference, centered as it is on the question of the cinematic voice? So there are two ways I have of attacking this question. I'm only going to give you one because time is short. The first one has to do with the fact of the confessional voice. So we see Harry go to confession in the conversation, but there's also a confessional sequence in Vertigo, which is when Kim Novak, as Judy Barton, after James Stewart leaves her apartment, sits down to write a letter in which she does confess everything to him, and we get a narrative voiceover, which is interestingly in a voice that's neither Judy Barton's nor Madeline Elster's. I think it's actually, shall I say, Kim Novak's voice. But then she tears up the letter and throws it out. And then there's the confession that we see performed by Hackman, which has a very interesting complication, which I can talk about later, but won't talk about now. But instead, and as I move toward a close, I want to return to the second example, the second way of thinking about what this means. and it has to do with a different version of Harry's inner authentic voice from the one we are supposed to be, perhaps to be seeing in the confessional, and that's his soulful saxophone playing. The first time we see Harry play, we actually, not in the sequence I just showed you, but in an earlier sequence, we see him off screen before we see him playing, and he plays in solitude, privately as it were, and yet his sax is accompanied. In one of the film's many moments of obsession with diegetic sources of its sounds, we discover that Harry is playing along with a vinyl recording, what musicians used to call, maybe still do, a music minus one recording. So we see him, we hear the music, we see him playing, and then we see the actual source of the recording. As we've seen, near the close of the film, Harry takes up his sax again, as if in a moment of self-consolation for all for the catastrophe he's witnessed. And he sits down, and he plays with the music minus one again. And then the phone rings, although no one's supposed to have his number. He picks up the phone and no one responds. And then minutes later, this is where I cut, the phone rings again, and this time a voice, probably Harrison Ford, says, "We're listening to you." And then it plays back the bars that Harry has just played on his saxophone. The moment, of course, works to mark a final reversal of Harry's chief life orientation, that he is able to listen to others from behind the security of his own protective casing, his call. But for now, Harry is himself being overheard by those on the other side of the membrane. His response is to embark on a manic search for the bug, a search that leaves his apartment in disarray. In the film's memorable conclusion, we see Harry sitting alone in his demolished apartment, again playing his saxophone. Its lonely voice no longer has the accompaniment of the diegetic sound source of the music minus one recording. The record player, after all, has been destroyed along with everything else in his apartment. Now instead, Harry's plaintive sax is accompanied by the non-diegetic piano that has accompanied him throughout the film score and that we heard just at the beginning. So this is the last clip, and it's
okay,
a short one.
Okay, and then we need to have time for discussion. So.
Okay. We had these technical difficulties with questions. Well, one picture. So this scene is actually shot with a camera that comes from the diegesis of the film itself. It's a surveillance camera that's on display in the convention they all go to. Brilliant as this closing sequence is, it's not a radical break with the conventions of narrative filmmaking, not even with the so-called classical system of narration. This final duet between Harry's diegetic vocalization through a saxophone and the haunting piano of the score does stand as an emblem of Coppola's work with the vocal image. So returning to Coppola's trick with the central vocalization in the film, in which the pivotal line is differently stressed to reflect a new understanding of the circumstances, it seems we have to qualify any conclusion that Coppola's turn to the voice as a function merely of his effort to bring realist psychological interiority to the psychodrama of a Hitchcock thriller. The voice, it seems, is not a better index of interiority than the face, though it may elicit a different structure of the relationship between interiority and exteriority, newly coded in the sound-generated tensions of the diegetic and the non-diegetic. I have a concluding paragraph, but I can skip it.
Okay.